Welcome to It's All About the Story, Grief Stories That Connect Us. This podcast takes you into the lives of people who have gone through loss and have come out the other side to experience joy again. Each story is someone's lived experience and reveals how wrestling with grief can turn loss into wisdom. You might even find some of these insights helpful in your own grief journey. Come, meet the people like yourself who have experienced loss and who now openly share their story with us. And now, here is your host, Rick Berg.
Well, welcome everybody to It's All About the Stories, Grief Stories That Connect Us. It is good to be together. Thank you so much for joining me today for another one of our episodes. And please share this with your friends and family. Share some of the podcasts in the past as well, because I think all of us can identify with our different guests and they're very helpful for us as well. So really excited that you're with us today. And you know, folks, sometimes unexpected events happen in our life that can knock us down. How we get up and move forward in the midst of transition is really significant. I think also sometimes we might have to reinvent ourselves and find a new passion or a new purpose in order to experience life in all its fullness. I really believe that this is part of our guest story today, and perhaps one that might resonate with some of you who are maybe in transition in your own life. Now, it's not often you get to interview an Olympian, but today, I'm pleased to welcome Linda Schamleffel to It's All About Story. So, Linda, welcome.
Thanks, Rick. Thanks.
It's so good to have you here. And I mean, I want to get right into your story here. So, like I said, it's not often I get to, you know, interview another Olympian. So, can you tell us about that road that led you to the 1976 Montreal Olympics as a rower?
It was a fluke. It kind of was. When I was a teenager, I saw rowing for the first time, and it was only for men. But I just fell in love with the beauty and the poetry of the movement of rowing. And I, as a child, rowed on the lake in front of our house. So I liked the water and I liked rowing, but it was beautiful. I loved it. So I went through all through university, and rowing was just for men. Then I became a teacher, and in about, I think it must have been 1973, they were giving me student teachers, and the student teacher said, "Oh, I'm going off to rowing." I go, "What? Women row? Oh, I'd love to do that, but I'm too old." She said, "No, you're not too old. Why don't you come on out?" So I went out, and the first day I fell in the water, but I picked it up quickly because of my background of rowing my boat and fishing. So I just kept doing it because I loved it, and it was beautiful. Just the movement of it was beautiful, and I was pretty athletic, and so I was, you know, maybe above average doing it. Anyway, shortly thereafter, this opportunity came down where Canada was hosting the 76 Olympics, and every host country gets to introduce some sports and maybe eliminate some sports. So that year, they introduced four sports. I don't know what the others are, but including women's rowing. And that was the first time women rowed in the Olympics. And so they formed a Canadian national team. And this questionnaire came down, "Do you want to row?" I said, "Well, sure. Let's give it a go. So I got on the national team program, and nobody knew what they were doing. They thought women would break if they rowed. But so we just kept going along. And through the selection camps and everything, and I ended up being chosen for one of the boats. Wow. So off we went to the Olympics.
What was that like being at the Olympics as an athlete?
It was really surreal, totally surreal, because we rowed in seclusion. And then we went to the village a week before the Olympics started to habituate to the course. And that year was the first year they had gunmen at every corner because of what happened in 72, where mm-hmm. athletes got killed by terrorists. So everything was, I'm saying again, surreal. Everything was surreal. However, we just stayed narrowly focused on our job and rode. So because we were so focused, I think that we didn't have time to enjoy a lot of the stuff and didn't really realize the impact of being in the Olympic Games.
Right.
Like now I realize that more, that it's not just, let's go to the Olympics. No, I mean, very, very few people go to the Olympics, compete in the Olympics. And so my memories are totally fond. But when I was there, I was really focused on rowing.
So you come out of the, what did you do after? No, so did you say you were a teacher?
Yes, I was teaching senior high school. I was.
Oh, okay. So that is that what you returned to then after the Olympics to teaching?
I did. And so I returned to teaching in 76, the fall of 76. And then in the spring of 70 or the winter of 76, 77, my life took a change or a turn because I was skiing and I was in a bad accident. I was a victim of a bad accident in skiing. And it was turns out to be my fourth traumatic brain injury. And so in 77, my life started going sideways. Like I could feel my life drifting away and I couldn't hang on to it. And nobody knew anything about traumatic brain injuries at that time. So I got out of teaching in 79 because the noise was so loud and that was part of a traumatic brain injury. Like, oh God, yeah. It was just so loud. I had to get away from the noise. And I went into real estate, which I love architecture. It's another love of mine. So I went into real estate and was pretty good at that. But in 1989, I was a victim of a car accident. And that was my fifth brain concussion. And my life just went sideways.
Can you tell us a little bit about that sideways after that? So it was a vehicle accident?
Yes, I was rear-ended. Anyway, there were so many aspects to that, but one of the aspects was my brain wasn't working. I couldn't remember anything. I could barely remember my own name. My head hurt. The light was too bright. Smells were too strong. Everything gave me a headache. And that was one aspect of it. It was the physical symptoms of a brain injury. And the second thing was that it kind of, because of the timing, I was a victim of what was going on in society. Like, for example, ICBC just changed their definition of injury. If there's no blood, there's no injury. And so I didn't have any blood. I had internal damage and I had a brain injury, but no blood. And so they said, you're faking. There's no blood. There's no injury. And I just went, no, that's wrong. That's wrong. And I couldn't talk and I couldn't defend my position about that. And then my doctor, I couldn't believe it, this either, but at that time, the doctors were fighting with the government for more money. And so I walked into my doctor's office after the car accident, and she said, here, take these antidepressants and painkillers and don't bother me, because it would have been a lot of time that she wouldn't have got paid for. So it was her agenda. And I went, what? Wow. And then the third thing was the lawyer I got. I didn't know this until after, but the lawyer I got, there's this list of lawyers that ICBC hires, and mm-hmm. he was on that list. And so he was defending me and wanting to work for them. So it was a conflict of interest. And I could see it because I studied law in grade 11. I could see it was a conflict of interest, but I couldn't get out of it. And I couldn't explain it because I couldn't talk because of my brain injury. So I was angry, like really, really angry, because I could see I was victimized by the systems that were promised to help me.
Mm.
And I went, whoa, life sometimes doesn't work out like the promise.
Mm-hmm.
So I was working in alternate health things like reflexology and a whole pile of different stuff and healing my body. And we kind of thought it was fibromyalgia or chronic fatigue, which people didn't know about, but it really messed up your brain. Mm-hmm. Nobody twigged that it was a brain injury. So after 10 years, I was physically a lot better, but my brain still wasn't working. And I had a different doctor then, and she had been a national team swimmer. So she got me a bit more. Mm. She got my, like, I want performance and high standard. And so she said something that really helped me turn the corner. She goes, okay, look, Linda, you have to make a choice. Do you want to be right about ICBC and the doctors and all that stuff? Do you want to be right or do you want to be happy? I said, I am right. I am right. She goes, yeah, you may be right, but if you want to be happy, you have to let go of that. And I go, ah. So I thought about it and I thought, okay, what do I really want? Do I want to be right and be so frustrated? Or do I just want to be happy? So I did not forgive them, but I let them go.
Yeah.
I let them go. And then that was the next big turning point in my life.
You know, that's really fascinating because a few episodes ago, I interviewed a gentleman about concussion. He'd been through really some severe concussions in his life. And he was kind of even sharing now some of the struggles within the system to be recognized. You know, that brain injury is a big deal. And sometimes it's hard to diagnose for people, or sometimes people don't actually maybe listen the way they should and kind of say, well, come on, you know. And it's fascinating because you think that, and that was 1989, and still there seems to be a lot of lack of knowledge around brain injury and the impact that it has on individuals.
Yes, there is. Yeah. Because it's hard to measure.
Yeah.
And, you know, the systems kind of go on measurement. If you can measure it, it exists.
Yeah.
And if you can't, then it's our word against your word.
Yeah. So, I mean, I read some of your on your websites there. I mean, it got so hard for you, difficult for you that, I mean, you even like suicide thoughts were even there.
Yeah, that's right. So the accident was in 1989. And my brother died and my mother died. And I took on my aunt with Alzheimer's, and I had this brain injury and my body hurt, and I couldn't walk straight for 10 years. Like, I staggered and everything hurt. And and so I got the degree of suicidal where thinking of suicide, it's the one before trying suicide. Yeah. And I was in that place for about 2 years.
Wow.
You know, just, and on one hand, that sounds sort of tragic, but on the other hand, what that was for me was this opportunity to have a conversation with the Creator. Like, I wasn't religious before, and I'm not church religious now, but I was talking to somebody and talking about the pros and cons. Well, you know, you can come home to heaven, or you can stay there. And if you come home, here's the pros and cons. And if you stay there, here's the pros and cons. And I'm going, oh, okay. So I had this conversation for about 2 years. And then I went, I think, oh, well, the funny thing was, thanks for asking, because it reminded me, what helped me turn the corner was my neighbor came over to borrow a cup of sugar. And I was laying in a fetal ball in the middle of the living room, as I had been for a couple of years. And he says, yeah, but Linda, just think of how much you will have learned that you can teach others. And I went, oh, my God, that's my purpose in life. That's absolutely true. I will learn a lot of stuff. If I stay here, I'll learn a lot of stuff. And then I can help other people. And that on that moment, I stood up out of depression. I went, I don't know how I'm going to do it. But that's the path I'm choosing, is to move forward and see what I can learn.
That's very powerful. You know, I mean, it's, as you know, I mean, I'm a bereavement educator and a grief counselor. So I deal with a lot of people who are in transition. And that one movement forward in transition is difficult to come to. But once people seem to, I guess, put one foot forward, and see that they have, you know, purpose still in life, that they can find meaning, that somehow that gives them a little bit more joy for living, I suppose.
That's right. And the Japanese have done a lot of study on the importance of purpose. They call it ikigai. Ikigai, I think. And they say it is so critical to have a purpose that without a purpose, you can't live. So you have to have a purpose, whatever that purpose is. It could be whatever it is. It doesn't have to be, you know, world level achievement. It could be sewing dresses for single mothers or something, you know, with children. Like it doesn't have to be big, but you have to have a purpose.
So then here you are, you're moving forward in your life. And so how did you discover your kind of new purpose or in life coming out of this?
Well, I still wasn't through my healing journey, because that healing journey took about 16 years.
Okay.
And I actually couldn't work for 16 years, but at the end of 10 years, when I decided I'd rather be happy than right, now it was the year 2000. And for some reason, I thought, whoa, maybe I have a brain injury. Because around that time, Norman Doidge is a Canadian guy, but a couple of books came out about brain injury or brain something.
Okay.
And I went, oh, I wonder if I have a brain injury. So my friend said, you have to learn the computer, Linda. The computers just came out around 2000.
Yeah.
You have to learn this. You have to. And so she gave me these kindergarten lessons on how to use a computer. And actually, it took me a month to remember how to turn it off, because my memory wasn't working. And I'd write it on a note, and then I couldn't find the note. I couldn't remember where the note was. But anyway, so I learned how to use a computer. And the kindest thing she said was, you don't have to know everything. Just learn as you need to. So anyway, I get on the computer in around 2000, and I found published medical research, PubMed.com.
Okay.
And so typed it in there, and they go, what question do you have? And I go, can a brain injury be healed? Can a brain injury be healed? And I decided that if it could, I'd stay and figure it out. And if it couldn't, I'd sell everything, go to Mexico, and die on the beach happily. So I went, can brain injury be healed? And so the answers come back, and they go, well, up to this point, we thought not. You know, like the slate, and it's full, and that's all you get. But now we think it can heal, but we don't know the mechanism for it. And I went, it's good enough for me. Right. If you think it can be healed, I'll stay curious and see if I can figure it out. So my part of my life really changed where good stuff started showing up. You know, I don't know how to explain that, but I was in a better partnership with the creator, and the creator goes, okay, I've got the big vision. You got the legs. We need both of them. So you got to get your legs better, because I've got the big vision, something like that. Then anyway, so things, synchronistic things started showing up. And I still had agoraphobia, fear of leaving the house. Once in a while, I'd go out, you know. So somebody I knew had this woman over, and she was demonstrating these hemispheric synchronization boards as a possible help to recover brain function. And so I went to this person's house, and she had these boards on. And she goes, oh, if your brain is okay, you can stand on this kind of balance board. You can stand on it really easily. I couldn't even stand on it. Like, I kept falling off, and I go, what's up with that?
Oh, no.
Like, why can they and why can't not I, right? So anyway, I went, okay, this woman knows something. I'm going to find out what she knows. And so I went down that path, and I learned the principles that she knew about how this board and the guy who invented it, who had 40 years of unpublished study, how it helped put the hemispheres back in sync. And so I got this idea that some brain injuries were like computers, and they just needed to be defragged somehow. Like some brain injuries, the stuff is crushed and mashed, but some, they just need to be defragged somehow. And I went, okay, good. So then I went back to PubMed, And I said, so how, I forget the question, but they, how can the brain be improved or something like that? And I wrote down what the abstract said. You know, one guy would say, well, when the rats or the people rub their fingertips, it showed the glial cells were expanding. Mm-hmm. Oh, fingertips. And then, so I wrote down all these things that I saw that the scientists had found, and then made them into a program, and then incorporated it with that woman who had these hemispheric synchronization boards. So I made this program.
Wow.
And so the brains were really the big thing at the really hot topic. So that somehow somehow the rec center heard of me, and somehow I got over there, and somehow they hired me, and somehow I was given classes on these boards. And if I wrote it in my appointment book, I'd remember to go, because my appointment book's my memory, right?
Right.
So, and then when I got there, I knew I had enough teaching background to conduct a class. So within 1 year, about 80 or 90% of my brain function came back. And I went, whoa.
Oh, my word.
And then I went, I have to make money. So I turned that into a little business called Power Brain Fitness. And I became really popular and in demand in, you know, the brain injury circuit in Western Canada, speaking and going around giving clinics until 2008 or nine, when there was a depression, an economic depression for about a year.
Right.
And it killed my business.
Mm.
So then I thought, well, what am I going to do now? And this is where synchronicity and being open.
Yeah.
You know, one of the things I say to people, say yes until you have to say no.
Right.
But say yes, like be curious, say yes.
Yeah.
And then when you need to say no, say no. Like yeah. You can keep yourself safe. So anyway, this is how it really started. So synchronistic. In 2010, Vancouver hosted the Winter Olympics.
Yes.
So in July 2009, somehow they chose me amongst thousands of people to be in that ceremonial torch, carrying the torch before the Olympics, right?
Yeah.
And the three outfits that were sponsoring the torch relay, they were trying to use it to help people start an exercise program. And I went, God, you want me to do another exercise program? Come on. But I said, okay, I'll play your silly game because that's fair. And so I was already walking. And I listed all the activities I could. First of all, I said, what is my objective? I want to look good on TV holding that torch.
Yeah.
That's my objective. So what do I have to do? Maybe strengthen my muscles. I don't know. Okay, what exercises will help me strengthen my muscles? So I wrote down this list, and I heard of pole walking. I thought it was stupid, but I put it on the list. And then I said, okay, I'm going to pick an exercise to keep my commitment to these, you know, relay guys. So I chose pole walking because it was the least amount of work I could do because I was already walking. So I just had to add poles to it.
Yeah.
So I thought, all right, let's see how this is supposed to be done. So I Googled it, and I'm a phys ed teacher and Olympic athlete. I looked at the videos and I went, they're doing it wrong. If I do it that way, like they're kind of reaching forward, if I do it that way, I'm not going to look good on TV. So yet again, I have to figure it out myself. So I just knew enough about how the body worked that I figured you had to push the poles behind you, and that would strengthen your back and give you good posture and strengthen your muscles and stuff. And little did I know that I was reinventing classic style Nordic walking.
Wow.
And anyway, so after a couple of months, my friends are going, what are you doing, Linda? Your posture looks so much better. And I'm like, I don't know. I just have to get smaller pants. So that was July. And then in October, the end of October, I carried the torch. I look good on TV. And then the next day I went, I don't have to do this stupid pole walking anymore. I just went plane walking. Ooh, plane walking is hard. It's no fun at all. It's hard to do. relative to Nordic walking. Yeah. So the day after that, I picked up the poles again. I like pole walking. It feels good. It feels good on the body. So then the next year, my friend said, well, Linda, you're looking so great. Maybe you should teach us how to Nordic walk. I said, well, I need a job. Okay, I'll figure it out and I'll create classes, which I did. And then that was I think that was the end of 2011. And I put the poles away for the year, and then synchronicity again. I get this phone call out of the blue from this guy from Berlin. Hello, Linda. And I'm going, oh, a stalker. And he persisted. Every week he phoned. And he says, do you know all about me? And I'm going, psychopath. I know all about you. I go, how do you know about me? He says, well, I Googled you. And I go, oh, God. So I Googled this guy, and he's this god of Europe, this athletic god of Europe. Oh, God. So luckily, he phoned again. I said, what do you want? He goes, good. Now you're going to listen. I'm going to tell you. So he brought the company Nordics Canada to Canada. And he wanted a strong teacher out in the West Coast. And he Googled me. And I was Olympian. And I was already pole walking. And hey, perfect match, right? That's how he found me. So I joined worked with their company. And have been teaching people to pole walk time flies. Simple Mass shows, 9 or 10 years.
Wow. Well, I mean, that was when, you know, obviously Erica, my wife, and I first met you, because we took one of your sessions here at Pacific Landing, Nordic pole walking.
That's
and,
right.
I had kind of the same feeling that you did when I wasn't even going to come that night, to be honest with you. I said, Erica, like, this sounds like really silly. Like, I don't really know if I want to go to this. She goes, okay, well, I'm just going by myself anyways. You know, you can join me if you want, kind of thing. You know?
Yeah.
But I thought, well, I better support my wife, you know. So I went down and took that session with you. And first I was learning how to do it, because there was a little bit of a trick to it, like you said, to learn how to do it properly. But I'm telling you, it's part of our exercise regime today, you know, and it definitely does what you, say it does. I can't believe it. I mean, we do normal walking and other exercises as well, but boy, I'll tell you, as far as the posture goes and the strengthening of the back muscles, I'm going, I need to pole walk today. I need, even, you know, doing it, you know, 3 or 4 times a week is just amazing. So for those people who are listening on, could you give a brief description of what the benefits or like pole walking is?
Oh, sure.
What are the benefits of that?
Sure. So classic Nordic style pole walking is taken from cross-country skiing, where they push the pole, the last half of the cross-country ski pole push. Mm-hmm. They're pushing the poles back to propel themselves forward. So Nordic pole walking is taken from that action. And when our muscles work when we push against resistance. So when we're walking along, our feet are pushing against the resistance of the sidewalk.
Right.
And so when we're walking, because we're pushing against resistance, we engage about 45% of the muscles. Wow. But when we pole walk, our upper body, especially classic style, our upper body and our back, because we're pushing back, our upper body and our back and our core muscles, all of this is being engaged because our upper body is pushing against the resistance of the ground via the poles. And so it engages all these upper body muscles. And then you're using 90% of your muscles, 90%. So happily, the 10% that aren't used are the trapezius. That's like, oh, my God, I'm so stressed. And the scapular levator, you know, this is sitting at the desk. Your head is like this and your shoulders are like that.
Mm-hmm.
Well, those muscles, those two muscles get to relax when you're Nordic walking and lets all that tension and stress go out. So Nordic walking uses twice or twice the calories of regular walking, about 560 calories per hour.
Wow.
Twice the calories, and anybody can do it. And it doesn't matter if you go fast or slow,
mm-hmm.
because this exercise is about using the muscles.
Yeah.
So that's a pretty cool thing.
It is.
In the olden days, you know, when running was a fad, because the faster you run, the more yeah. you huff and puff and everything, the better it is for you. Ideas have changed.
Yeah.
You breathe enough with Nordic walking, but it's how many muscles are you using and repetitively, like the workload. What?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've noticed that. I mean, when we go out, I find if I go too fast, it's not as effective for me. I like to, because I need to stretch back with, you know, make sure I'm going back to the elevator, like you said, back to the
yeah.
elevator, right? And
yeah.
I find it amazing. So how many, like you've been doing this for 8 years, how many, so do you still offer classes to people, and is it still part of your work?
Yes and no. So over the years, I've taught over 2,500 people, mostly wow. in Victoria. And when COVID hit in 2020, it stopped my classes because, you know, there were group classes out on the street or a trail somewhere. So the classes just stopped like that.
Mm-hmm.
And now, last year and now, I have been giving private lessons or semi-private, like a husband and a wife or okay. two friends in the bubble.
Mm-hmm.
And I feel, and we feel safe enough to do that outside, to learn outside and do that. So I have been doing a few of those, but really, again, the universe is amazing. You know, it's like you're on this wild horse and you just got to stay on. So when COVID hit, it really was a big opportunity for me to transform everything that I know into some kind of an online program, which I've done.
Oh.
Yes, we're just in the marketing part now, but. And I tested it, actually. Like, people say, well, how can you teach somebody a physical skill through Zoom, for example? I figured it out. And so when my course is launched soon, what people get, and this is like people all across Canada and United States, mm-hmm. that'd be good, right? They get a video. I made this video library, all these little pieces of the picture of learning to set up the poles and learning to yeah. Nordic walk. Like I'm capturing what I know and I'm putting down little videos.
Wow.
So they have this video base and they get two pairs of poles, them and a buddy. And then they're kind of self-learning because they look at the videos and then they go out and they do it.
Mm-hmm.
But we come together every week
oh.
and they can send me, they can email me a video of their buddy videoing them as they walk along.
Brilliant.
So I can put the video on Zoom and we both can look at it. And then I can
point out,
say, see that right there? That needs to be like this over here.
Wow.
So actually, the universe is pretty amazing because it shows up for me what I need. Back in about October of last year, this lady from Washington State phones me out of the blue. She goes, I want you to sort of teach me and certify me as a Nordic walk instructor in Canada. I've taken the instruction in the US and I wasn't that impressed. So I want you to teach me. I go, oh, sure, I'd do that because I'm qualified to do that. And she says, when COVID's over, I'll come up to Victoria and take your day-long course. I'm going, no, I think we can figure out a smarter way to do it.
Yeah.
And so, I already had the video, the library of videos. So she got the library of videos and I sent her the two pairs of poles. And then I said, okay, every week you have to send me a video. Get your neighbor or mm-hmm. hubby or whatever to video going along. And we're going to meet. I'm going to coach you over Zoom. And exactly what we did. We looked at her video and really, as a teacher, I can't do anything more than that. It's just as effective on Zoom as it is in person because the person who has to make the change is not me. It's the student, right? And I think they can see it and understand it better when I'm pointing to their little video. I do believe that.
Wow. So you said June is going to be coming out in June. So in the show notes below this podcast, then would there be a place to contact you about that course? I can talk to that after the session here, but are you willing to put your contact information down there?
Sure. And actually, we'll figure out the technology, but actually I have this little freebie right now. I did a bunch of research to find out how people made out with exercise, all kinds of exercise. Mm-hmm. And in the end, what stopped people the most, it wasn't the exercise they chose, although some were better than others. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't the teacher they had, although some were better than others. It was they didn't know how to persist. They didn't know how to persist. That's where they failed. They stopped. Wow. And so learning to persist, in my view, is a skill that needs to be learned. It's not something that's implanted in you. It's a skill, just like any other skill. And when my online course is rolling, then that's half the course is learning, getting over the tipping point of mm-hmm. persistence.
Wow.
Plus learning how to Nordic walk, these two things. Anyway, to that end, I've got this, my freebie called, just wait, I got to read it. It's called Winning the Battle for Lifetime Fitness, 10 Insiders Secrets to get you out the door to exercise. So that's my freebie, and maybe we can arrange for your listeners to have that.
That would be great. That would be great. Well, you know, I want to... I know you have a bigger story than what we can share here, but it's been amazing to talk to you. And I mean, you've transitioned and a number of times in your life, and you reinvented yourself a few times in your life. So I think it's really important to just ask you a final question, you know, because in those transition, obviously there's always loss. There's always things that, you know, there's grief and loss. And I'm wondering, you know, your philosophy of life, what would you say to a person, you know, who has faced unexpected losses in their life, and how might they come out the other side as you have?
A good question. You know, I can't even begin to imagine all the feelings that people have about all the different kinds of losses they have. But maybe I can offer the three philosophies that really helped me. Mm-hmm. This was my inheritance from my dad. My dad says his philosophy was, there's a solution. It's your job to find it and to take action. That was his life philosophy. Like self-responsibility. There's a solution and it's your job to find it and take action. So that, you know, when people adopt that philosophy, it takes them out of the backseat of victimhood and puts them into the front seat of driving the car. Yeah. And you have to be there. You have to drive the car, even if wobbling down the road, you have to drive your own car. And then the second thing that I think really helped me was a fundamental attitude shift. That you'll remember this one. Do you want to be right or do you want to be happy?
That's good.
You know, because when you're all involved in being right, you're immobilized over here in your life. Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, you're all tied up here and you can't take action over there.
Yeah.
And so we need to be in this place where we can take action. Yeah. Both of those first two philosophies say we got to put ourselves in this place where we can be in action. And then the third one is, I'm reading it here because I like it. You have to be curious about life and trust that life is essentially good. Mm-hmm. And then when the door opens, go through it. Like just go through it. Yeah. And if you don't like it, say no, turn a different direction, go through a different door. But when a door opens, go through it because the universe is inviting you. Mm-hmm. And the universe is pretty smart.
Yeah.
You know, so stay curious and say yes and go through doors and see what happens. And if it's not working out, change directions, but just keep going.
Yeah, that's wonderful. I think that's such a wonderful message during the time of COVID too, when there's so much unknown out there in people's lives. And, you know, people are scared and frightened a little bit about their future, but, you know, it's amazing that even now there's opportunities, like you said. I mean, sometimes, you know, the old phrase of, you know, make lemonade out of lemons. And everybody's going through a lot of losses in life right now, but there's good things happening out there. And I love that. So, well, Linda, I just want to thank you again for being on the podcast. And we'll get some information in the notes for the listeners here. So I want to thank those who have listened on today. And I know that you've been blessed with Linda's information and her wisdom and her story. And so I want to just thank you again for being with us, Linda.
Thank you so much for having me here today.
And for those who are listening on, I hope you have a good day. Till next time, it's all about the story, Grief Stories That Connect Us. Bye-bye.
Thanks for joining us today on It's All About the Story, Grief Stories That Connect Us. We hope this podcast was encouraging to you. There are so many different types of loss. Why not take time to listen to some of the other unique stories in this podcast series? Feel free to share them with family, friends, neighbors. If you'd like to receive notifications about the next episode in the series, please subscribe and we'll make sure you don't miss out. We hope that you'll be joining us again on It's All About the Story, Grief Stories That Connect Us, with host Rick Berg. Take good care.